get started, just a few reminders that next week, 1 week from this morning, you have your first exam. It'll be 8 to 9:30. It will go to 9:30. I'll ask my TA to cut it off then, regardless of how many are in there at the time. But we'll kind of cut it off earlier. It'll be in Hubble, so spread out. You are allowed a cheat sheet, just one side of an 8.5 by 11-inch sheet of paper, anything you want written on it. I do not want to see topological enhancements. I don't know, did that thing happen to you? Yeah, so none of the flat stuff. Yeah, that was amazing to me. Probably a prize to be given to whoever has the smallest pride in the machine. Just kidding. Good luck if you do that. I will include a formula sheet with the exam. It is my intent to also send that formula sheet out or post it on the web beforehand so you can see what it is that will actually accompany the exam. That said, I try not to do that until I've actually made out the exam and done the solution step myself so that I have so I'm sure I haven't thrown something at me that I feel I ought to put on the formula sheet. A better person would get that done well ahead of time. I never do. So you'll be lucky to see that the night before the test, probably, or the day before or something. So I'll try to do better, but no promises. That said, if you look at the one from last year's exam one, which is online, that's where I'll start, and unless I have to make a change, I won't make a change, so that's going to be 95% of it, and probably will be exactly the same. So you can see what you'll see on the coming with the exam by looking there, if that bothers you. I don't do practice exams. I have done practice exams many, many years, and they're all available on the web. They're called past exams. You're welcome. There are exams that have that are there with and without solutions, so I consider that reasonable practice for you. I generally try to have either the day before the exam or 2 days before the exam, I will schedule an hour and a half session where I don't call it a review session because I will not lead you through the things I think are important. I've been doing that. But I call it a Q&A session where you can come in and ask anything you want, and I will do my best to just answer it straight up. Whether you could ask specifically a question on the exam or not, I will just answer whatever. So the intent is not to lead you forward or away from things on the exam, simply try to ask or answer whatever questions you have at the time. Hard for me to do this time. I will be on the other side of the world, so I'm going to see if one of my TAs will be willing to do that for you, and then try to find a room. One issue with this is if ever I try to find a room for one of these things, it is truly impossible for me to find a room when everybody can make it. So we will try to find a room when there isn't a workshop scheduled and when the TA can actually do it, and you're welcome to show up if you can. If you can't, you know, you're welcome to send questions via email. You're welcome to send a friend to that session with questions. You're welcome to go to office hours that are scattered through the week. Obviously, mine are canceled next week, but the TAs have office hours scattered through the week. And you can ask questions in the POA library help office hours. They may not be directly associated with class, but anybody who's doing that who can't answer those questions unless they're technically like exactly what I allow or don't allow on some tests, shouldn't be doing those help okay, anything else about the exam? Anything anybody's worried about? Questions? About how it's going to go? Okay, so what you'll see is very similar to some of the past exams on the exams from the past. So I do suggest you go back and look at them just so you know what to expect. But I tend to try to give you somewhat different formats. I tend to try to test different levels. I tend to demand that you show me what you're thinking to get points most of the time, but sometimes I will do some sort of very short answer or multiple choice. There is a trade-off. I just want you to understand my pain in this, not for sympathy, but so you understand what's happening. When I make out these tests, It is my philosophy to make them in such a way that you have a crack at everything on the test, and you either do what you think you want to do and you're happy with it and you hand it in, or you have a crack at it and you're frustrated that you had a crack at everything, and so whatever. I don't like time being an issue. It's not what my goal is not, and some teachers have different goals in this. In my mind, having you realize that you have to work fast to get to the end and having that pressure you is not what I'm after. I'm not trying to test your ability to work under pressure really. Okay? So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, if I give you very few problems, I'm testing on relatively few things, and I run a risk of you maybe having pretty decent knowledge and me maybe hitting a couple of holes, so it's not quite a fair assessment of what you're doing. So in some sense, to cover all the stuff, maybe less bad for this exam than for some of the others, but many smaller problems is sometimes a better idea. Okay, so there's pressure on the other hand to try to give you more problems. And so these two things are always a balance in this class. And so I will do my best to try to strike a balance that I think is appropriate, and you just have to deal with whatever you get. And so I hope it's a decent balance, but sometimes you'll find that if the exam seems very long, it may very well be that, you know, I erred by giving you too many problems, or actually they're not too many problems because some of the ones that I gave you are actually meant to be quite easy, but maybe I wrote it in the wrong way and it didn't strike you as easy and you took more time on it than I was anticipating that you would. So these kinds of things happen. So when you're taking the test, what you need to do is to sit down, focus on what you're doing, and just do your best. If you find you're not getting finished, if you find you're stressed for time, the probability is very high that a large fraction of the class is also feeling the same thing. And because I do this this is one of the reasons why I do the renormalization. What it means is the mean will be a little lower than it would have been otherwise, not really by my design. And so that normalization in the end sort of evens things out. So just don't fret about it. Do the best you can. Okay? All right. And as you're reading it, if you think you don't understand something, I want you to raise your hand and ask the TA. So ask the TA what's on your mind, and they may or may not be able to help you, but their instructions will be to clarify things up to the point of actually answering the things that they're testing on that particular problem. Because I'm in Japan next week, there will be no lectures in Hoi next week. I could arrange to do such. I find that usually screws up synchronization, and there are lots of issues why it doesn't work so well necessarily to have guest lectures. I could do that, but it seems to work out okay if I just give lectures with slides and an audio file. So I'm going to do that on Tuesday, or I'll do that hopefully before Tuesday. You'll find it there. And on the class website, so check it out. If you have questions, feel free to email me. And Thursday, there'll just be an exam. So there'll be one online lecture for next week. And usually that works out okay, but if you have issues with this, let me know. If I travel more, I can try to arrange you something else. But any issues, questions? Okay. Broken glass. Okay. You see sharp edges? Probably. Stripper music up. I got up this morning and smoked too many doobies. Or it's okay for me to do this. Actually. Largely. So why would somebody step on glass like this and come up without blood all over their feet? I don't know if you think that, but there's not one piece of glass in here. There's lots of pieces of glass. Okay? They're not trivially small, but they're not huge, right? So I'd say most of them are, you know, the size of a quart. They're not flat, actually. These are beer bottles. In fact, some of you may know my son. I think I started doing this when he was David. And, you know, there are just some times in your life. There are times in your life when, as a parent, you feel like a bit of a failure. And then there are times in your life as a parent where you're totally the bomb. And this is one of those. So I took a case of beer bottles and I threw them in a plastic bag, a big garbage bag, and I sort of doubled or triple bagged it, right? And I sort of wrapped it up and I went out on the driveway and I threw it way up in the air. And so I took it and I was doing this repeatedly. And it didn't really occur to me that my son would like this. But he comes out, all of a sudden I hear this from the back, and "Dad, what are you doing?" I said, "I'm smashing beer bottles." And his face just goes, "Cool." I don't even know that he ever asked me why I was doing it. But he thought it was absolutely cool. So we smashed a bunch of beer bottles, and it is true that I took out the pieces that might be standing straight up, you know, like where the stem is, you might get a piece that stands straight. So I took those out, but all the others I left in here, okay? So why might I do this and not walk away with a bunch of cuts all over my feet?
Distribution of
the
weight?
Yeah. Yeah. Sort of. It's distributed, but there's more to it. Distributed across what? Maybe. I would do it if there was a small area. I mean, you can do a similar demo by, you know, lying on a bed of nails and having somebody break a brick on your chest or something with a sledgehammer. I wouldn't do that if the nails were spread out a lot, because then you would just have nails through your body. But if there's a lot of nails, you could do this. So it is more than just the distribution of weight. But maybe it's semantics. So there I am. Okay. So I have, if you want to think about it, the force is down on me, mg. Okay? And what supports me is the glass, basically. Now, while it is true that some of this glass is like so, and some of my weight might sort of go down on the flat parts, okay, fine, that certainly happens. But imagine in the limit that I have this really crushed up and I have nothing but points.
I would do the same thing. So each of these has what's called a normal force. Going up, which is the reaction force to the force that's going down. And so if you look at the sum of the forces on my body, on my feet, it is equal to the normal force, so the mg down minus which is equal to MA. I'm not accelerating anywhere. So MG is equal to this sort of sum of these different normal forces. So if I have lots of points that are supporting me, then I'm basically taking my weight and I'm distributing it along. I did manage to actually cut myself when I was pulling my foot off. Anyway. If I distribute it along enough of these points, then each individual force of a point on my foot, each normal force, is pretty small. And the reason that I remove the pieces of glass that are pointing up at a single point, because I don't want to put all of my weight on that point, otherwise I'll end up with glass in my foot. Okay? Somebody was puzzled. I would not do that, because if I did that, I have mg down here, I have 1 n here, and so mg is equal to n. My God, give me your work. And what that means is that normal force, which is the force of the glass on the bottom of my foot, is very large, and it will penetrate. But if I have that divided up about 200 points, then each of them sort of is supporting only about a few hundredths of my weight. So it's not actually pushing that hard against my skin, so it doesn't penetrate, and it's okay. You all right with that? Okay.
Anybody want to do it?
All right. So there we go.
Don't tell me I did that.
All right. With apologies, I left my notes in my office. I'll be back in a moment.
Thank you.
So, as with the glass example, I mean, if I have something and I place it here, why does it not crash to the floor? And it doesn't, because there's an equal and opposite force of it on the surface of the table, which is the force of the table that is on it. And we call that force the normal force. And you can draw it in different ways. Usually the symbol is N or F sub N. Sometimes people draw it like this. And the reason they do is because basically it's a force of the one surface on the other. You have to be a bit careful because the normal force is not always up and down, right? This thing on me, and the force happens at the is perpendicular to the two surfaces. So here I am leaning against the podium. There is a normal force here, the podium on me, and there's also a force of me against it, which we'll learn how to analyze, but basically, if there weren't a force here pushing against me, I would rotate down and hit the ground, right? I mean, you know that intuitively. And we'll quantify that. It's actually known as torque, so we know that there's a force on me as well. So I'm pushing against the podium. If it's all at rest, then the normal force and the other force that's pushing against it are equal in magnitude. So this is usually written like this, or F sub N, etc. Okay? So that is one of the forces that we'll be using in our Newton's law problems. And I wanted to introduce it briefly before we did the next example. So we're doing these Newton law problems. Basically, the theory you already know, which is this list of how one goes about and does these problems, I think that's basically useless. You really just have to do something. So that's what I want to do. So let us imagine that we have an inclined plane with an angle of 30 degrees with the horizontal. And we will say that we have a mass, M1, which is on the inclined plane, connected to a string that goes across a pulley, which is massless and frictionless, to another mass that is hanging freely, except for it's held by the string. We'll say that M2 is equal to 5 kilograms, and M1 is equal to 5 kilograms. So we'll say that there's no friction on plane, which maybe isn't so important to say right now because we really haven't done anything with friction, but within a week we'll be doing lots of stuff with friction, so if you want to not have friction, you'll have to specify it in these problems. So it slides frictionlessly up and down the plane, and we'll say that we have a massless and frictionless pulley, which again you may think is a needless complication here in the scenario that we're sort of going for the simplest case, but later we'll begin to have friction and or mass in pulleys and it significantly changes the problem. So I'm going to go ahead and start specifying that. So now the problem is that we sort of set things up like this.
So I'll say we put in place and release. And the question is, what I'll ask you to do is to describe the subsequent motion. And, you know, if you believe it will go one way or the other, this will either hit the ground here or this will slide down, hit the ground there. And I'm not actually asking you to describe anything after that. Right, when I say describe the subsequent motion, I really mean in the time where this begins to move, but before the problem changes because it starts hitting other stuff. Okay, so don't have that complication in. Even though English is subsequent motion, and if you want to really be precise about that, you would go beyond that. So describe the subsequent motion and find the tension, which I'll call T, in the rope or the string. Okay? So that's the problem. All right, so first of all, we have to get a sense of the problem itself. So one way to think about it is that here's our inclined plane. We have the pulley, we have the rope, we have this mass, and we have this mass. And if you think about what's going to happen, either it will balance and nothing moves, or the pulley will rotate this way, and the mass on the right will go down while the mass on the left goes up the inclined plane, or it will go the other way, like so. So those are sort of the two things that can happen. So what I'd like to do is, because the way that we do this is we draw free body diagrams for each of the relevant bodies, in this case the two masses, so we look at the forces on those, and then we want to analyze their motion, F equals ma. But notice, in this case, when one goes down an inch, the other goes up the inclined plane an inch, right? So my choice of coordinates that I want to marry together is, for the right-hand one, I want to do the vertical coordinate, and for the left-hand one, I want to have it parallel to the inclined plane. You okay with that? I also need to define what I consider to be positive motion or negative motion. But sort of once I make that transformation, I tie them together, it's almost like a one-dimensional problem. So I will define, in this case, positive to be like that, okay? Which means I have plus y this way, and I'll call this plus y. So I'll call it y, I don't care, even if it's going down the inclined plane. I'll consider that my plus y. I could choose the other way. It is, at this point, completely arbitrary. But once you make the choice, everything gets fixed according to that. And you have to stay consistent with the choice, okay? That's where you screw up if you don't stay consistent with it. All right, so once we've done that, then we do Newton's laws. So basically, we then do a free body diagram, or sometimes you might see it abbreviated as FBD, of M2. Here's my M2. If we think of the forces that are on it, there are two. One is the tension in the rope. The other is the force of gravity down, which is M2 times G. FBD for mass 1 we have M1G down We have a tension which is parallel to the inclined plane. And it is very important to note that the symbol I use here for T and the symbol I use here for T are the same. I'm indicating that it is the same force. It's different in direction, but the magnitude is the same. I point that out in part because very shortly we'll have mass and pulley, and when you have mass and pulley, the thing that that does is it actually changes that. So it's a subtlety that I want you to sort of begin to think about now. But the way to think about it is this rope is pulling down here and it's pulling up here at just different ends of the same rope. A pulley without mass does nothing except redirect the direction of that force. That's all it's doing. And what else do I have here? There's a normal force that we have to put in, and that normal force is going to be at right angles to the surface that's touching the mass, so I'll put it up like that. Okay? Okay, to be explicit, I'll call this T2, this T1. But now the magnitude of T1 is equal to the magnitude of T2, which is equal to what I'll just call T. All right, now the next step is to apply Newton's law, second law, to this mass and that mass separately. If we do mass 2, then the sum of the forces we only need to worry about along the y direction is equal to m2 times a in the y. So this would be the acceleration of mass 2 in the y direction. And we have defined positive to be going like so. So I'm going to define this force as positive in the sum. So this will be equal to a plus T minus M2 times G. You okay with that? I'm going to make a little room because the other one's a little more complicated. Choose my orthogonal coordinate, orthogonal meaning at right angles to one another. So I want to choose my coordinates such that one of them goes up and down like this way, okay? And I called it y earlier. So that's my plus y direction. So I have to have something at right angles to it. Doesn't really matter what I call it. I'll call it plus z. So z literally is the coordinate that's going at right angles to this inclined plane. So those are my two orthogonal pieces. And now the next step in Newton's laws is you want to decompose each of the vectors such that you are looking at their components along the appropriate orthogonal axis. T is along y here, n is along z, so those are fine.
But M1G here is
I have a laser that's stuck on. M1G is at some weird angle. So what we know is this angle, which happens to be, I called it alpha earlier, 30 degrees. So there are different ways to think about this. One way to think about it is to sort of draw a fictitious line here that is parallel to this line. And now that means this angle here by interior angles, interior opposite angles of parallel lines, or this angle is equal to that angle right here between these two. Okay? Which means it's complementary to... Oh, I have to do this more carefully. Sorry. Let's do it like this. Have a button that is placed on this thing, which is right where your wrist wants to rest when you're riding on it. Don't ask me what they were thinking when they designed it, this thing. So this angle is equal to that angle. This angle is complementary to that angle. The sum of those is 90 degrees. This is 90 degrees. So that angle is the same angle. So what that means is that this angle is alpha. So if you're into visualization and geometry, good. The other way to think about this is to think about it this way. Well, there may be even further ways. But imagine that I have two planes with a nail through one of them and a hinge. And now I start lifting the top plane up. And as I do, the nail that's stuck in it also moves up, all right? So I can take this thing and do this. And when I do, the nail comes out like so. But notice that as this angle here opens up, this nail, which is straight down, opens up with the vertical line here. So those two basically open up together, meaning that this angle is the same as that angle. Those are the two ways I think about it. You may have your own way of doing it. Feel free to share it with your friends and problem sets and workshops and stuff like that. But that's how I think. So however it is, you need to make sure that you can sort of do this kind of transformation in your mind. Because what we need to do is to take this vector, M1G, which is straight down, and we need to decompose it into pieces that are what I'll call parallel to the inclined plane and perpendicular to the inclined plane. Or the parallel direction would be, it's along Y, and the perpendicular is along Z. So a way to think about that is there's my vector. I have hopefully just convinced you that this is my angle alpha. So the piece of this vector that is parallel is right here. So this will be equal to M1 times G. It is the opposite piece in the triangle.
Here's my triangle. So this vector has a magnitude that is m1 times g times the sine of alpha.
And this piece is the piece that's perpendicular to it, and it will have a magnitude m1 times g times the cosine of alpha. And this one has a magnitude of m1 times g.
You okay with that?
All right, so if you're good with that, then we need to sum the forces. Maybe I'll do it up here so we can see it while we're doing it. The sum of the forces in the z direction is equal to the mass of the object, and we're talking about mass 1, times the acceleration in the z direction. It's not moving in the z direction, so the acceleration is 0, so this is equal to 0. And that will be equal to n, which is along the z-axis going positive, minus the force which is along the z-axis and going negative, which is going to be only this m1g cosine theta. The tension is parallel, not perpendicular. So it doesn't come in. So it's m1g cosine alpha. And the sum of the forces in the y is equal to m1 times a in the y. That a in the y is exactly the same as this a in the y because the string doesn't stretch.
If this thing goes up at 1 meter per second squared, this thing goes down the inclined plane at 1 meter per second squared. Think of the string as just staying taut but not changing anything.
So the acceleration is the same. And that's going to be equal to the force on M1, which is the positive direction, which is M1 times g times sine alpha. Minus the force that goes in the negative parallel direction, which is T. And it is the same T that we talked about a moment ago. All right. So now if you look at this, we have... we don't know AY... We don't know the tension. We're given the mass. We don't know the normal force. We don't know AZ, which is also AY. AZ we do know because that's 0. So we don't know the normal force. Alpha we're given. Tension we don't know. AY we don't know. So we basically have 1, 2, 3 equations and 2 unknowns.
I'm sorry, 3 equations and 3 unknowns.
In this particular problem, I've only asked you to find 2 things. I haven't asked you what the normal force is. I've asked you for the subsequent motion, which means the acceleration, and I've asked you for the tension in the rope. So at this point, you recognize you have 3 equations, 3 unknowns, and then it's soluble. This is actually a really good check to do, and it's important to do it, because if you count up the things you don't know and that you need, and you count up the number of equations, and you have more things that you don't know than you have equations,
you should rethink the problem, because it means you may be missing something. Sometimes it may mean that actually when you do this solution, something you don't know is going to cancel out. So
it is something that should make you think about what you're doing. All right, so in this case, we want AY and T. So if, in fact, it's been a while since you've done much algebra, and you have any problems with how to go from those three equations to solve for each of the unknowns, I need you to get that fixed like this week. Talk to friends, find a tutor, look up algebra on the whatever, but get real good at that, because even now I'm going to assume you know how to do that. All right. If you set up the problem correctly and you have the right equations, you will do pretty good with the points on the problem, in that we're not going to screw you too much for the algebra, but you will lose points if you mess up the algebra more so than you would if you just made a small number of plugging in things or have a small sign error at the bottom. Okay? And sometimes, depending on how the TA is thinking about it, if in fact you make an algebraic error in solving these things, and when the TA looks at it, they think you've actually set up one of the initial equations incorrectly because maybe they gloss over it a little bit, then you lose lots of points, because that's where what we're trying to teach you is really important. So it's a good idea to make sure you really are comfortable with how to do in equations and in unknowns. And in fact, you can practice on these, because when I do this, you should be able to convince yourself that AY is equal to M1 times G times the sine of alpha minus M2 times G over M1 plus M2. And when you solve for T algebraically here, you get M1 times M2 times G times 1 plus sine of alpha over M1 plus M2. Now, you'll note in this problem, you have alpha, you have M1, and you have M2, and you could look at this and go, why are you dragging all those symbols around and having these very complicated expressions when, in fact, I could just put in numbers for a lot of those, right? I know G, I know the M's, etc. And I don't do that for very, very good reasons. The moment I put in numbers, I sort of lose track of what it is, what it represents. It's not just a number. It's a number with units. So the moment I convert it into a number and drop the unit, I no longer really have track of that unit. And right now, one of the most important handles I have is to look at these stupid equations and do unit analysis to make sure that at least I have the correct units here. So the first thing I want to do is to check units. What units do I want on the left-hand side here? What is it? What does AY represent? It's an acceleration. Units of acceleration are what? So that means the right-hand side, when I look at it, and it better have units of meters per second squared. What are the units of sine alpha? It has no units. Right? It's just a sine of something. That's unitless. I have a mass times an acceleration. I have a mass times an acceleration. The difference here gives me units here of a mass times an acceleration. On the bottom, I have a mass plus a mass. That's units of mass. So I have a mass times acceleration over a mass. The right-hand side has units of acceleration. All right, so you're good with that? On the bottom, tension has units of what? It's a force. Force has units of, the way I think about it, is F equals ma. M is kilograms. A is meters per second squared. So the units of tension have to be kilograms, meters per second squared.
Does that make any sense? 1 plus sine alpha has no units. They're both just numbers. G is meters per second squared. I have 2 times kilograms divided by kilograms, so I have kilogram meters per second squared, units of the force. So the units are good. Then I'd like to look and see if the answer actually makes any sense in the limit of something that I just know the answer. Okay? And quite honestly,
I don't consider this completely obvious, what's going to happen if I have 2 masses that look like this. Okay?
But there are limits in which I sort of do know what's going to happen. If this mass, which we call mass 2, is really big, then I know this is going to basically drop with an acceleration of g in the negative y direction. Because it's going to be so much bigger than this, it's all going to be irrelevant. So, in the case where m2 is very big, ay is equal to m minus m2g, so it's negative and it's huge. So it's so big that all of this is negligible, so I have just minus m2 times g, divided by m1 plus m2. M1 plus m2, when m2 is really big, is just m2. So I have m minus m2g over m2, which just gives me minus g, which makes sense. Okay? If I have m1 being really, really big, then I have basically m1 times g times sine theta. This is the component of g which is along the plane, so that actually makes sense. This is negligible, and I end up with a component of acceleration, 1 in the positive direction, and it is the component of g which is along the plane. So again, it makes sense. All right? Tension may be a little harder to think about because as these 2 masses get really big, you effectively get infinity over infinity, which means you need to use L'Hopital's rule to take derivatives and see if it sort of begins to make sense. But either way, excuse me, and actually I'm not sure it makes a whole lot of sense because in a limit where this is infinite and this is small, I'm not sure what it means when you talk about the tension in the rope. Well, I guess it would have to be big enough that you pull this at g straight up the plane. But, okay, there's one other thing we can check. And that is, when alpha is equal to 90 degrees, what that says is it is the case where the inclined plane is straight up, which means it is this problem, which we did last time. And in fact, when alpha is 90 degrees, sine alpha is 1. So that would be m1 minus m2 times g over m1 plus m2, and you would have, this would be a 2g. I think, in fact, if you go back and you look at the solutions we had last time, you'll find that they agree. So that's another thing in principle you can check. So any questions on this? So just a little few words of warning, right? You need to be systematic and anal to do these, basically. If you start cutting corners, you'll get a sign wrong, you'll choose the angle incorrectly or something like that. Just take your time and do it slowly. There is no magic. I often will get a student come to my office and says, effectively, tell me the easy way to do this. And I just did. There is no easier way. Okay? It's the only way. If you start taking shortcuts, you start getting 50-50 chances of just being dead wrong. It just doesn't work. So you got to think your way through it.
And you have lots of opportunities to check yourself with units and limiting cases, so you want to take advantage of those. Okay, I will consider this to be the end of material for exam one. So it'll be Newton's law problems that might involve normal forces, certainly might involve tensions, could be in two or three dimensions depending on whatever, but basically there. It will not involve friction, which is about where I'm about to go. Okay? Yes?
Since the two
messes
are equal,
okay,
so what happens with the motion?
Sine theta is less than 1. So it will be accelerating in a negative way. A way to think about that would be, since the masses are equal, this mass is just hanging with its full weight. This mass has some of its weight literally supported by the normal force of the inclined plane, so the piece that's pulling on the string is going to be left, which means this one's going to win in terms of how the string moves. So that's what happens if the masses are the same. So that's a little bit what I mean by what you want to do is to leave all the symbols in and everything. And when you get to the end, yes, check limiting cases, check units. But, you know, think about, now does it make physical sense? And very often what you'll find is the problem will be in such a way that when you look at it, at first you're like, I have no idea what's going to happen. But when you actually begin to figure out how it works and you look at it, you ought to be able to, in many instances, sort of figure out what's happening and relate it to these equations and sort of know that it's the right thing. It makes sense after a while. Okay, so let us imagine that we have two surfaces, like a box on the floor or something like that. And if we look at it at a microscopic level, these surfaces are not super smooth necessarily. They may be made up literally of macroscopic pieces. And if I try to slide one of these objects across the other, literally they can physically have pieces sticking up, stopping each other. You also could imagine at a microscopic level, chemically, you all have done lots of chemistry, you may imagine that you have regions of different degrees of electronegativity or whatever, you know, electric charge buildup, dipoles and such. Imagine that you have a material where you locally have little electric dipoles here and here. And, you know, if I have negative over here and positive over here and positive over here and negative over here and they're near each other, they're going to sort of attract each other a bit. And if this is at one surface and this is the other, you'll have a little bit of attraction between them. You have this kind of thing even when you have non-polar molecules. You have, in many instances, you'll have these kinds of sort of, it's not strong enough to rip the molecules apart, but you'll have sort of molecule-to-molecule forces or surface-to-surface forces. So things like the van der Waals force is sort of similar to this. So you can imagine there's room for these types of forces. I lost the doohickey that I write with. There it is, thank you. Alright, so we call that force the force of friction. And we're not going to worry so much about the macroscopic aspects of it, okay? But there are a few things that we can think about. You can imagine if you put your hands together, right? You do this a little bit, and you move your hands. It's okay to do it. You can do it. It's cool to participate. All right? You do this, and you press a little bit. What do you feel?
It gets warm. Right? So that's one thing you get. If you press hard, it gets harder to slide. Right? Okay, so there's a few things. The other thing is, here I have this hand. I'll just try to hold it still. Now I take this hand and I try to slide it up. It exerts a force on this hand, which is that way. Right? I press this way, and if I try to slide, it pulls the other hand with it. So you get this strangeness that the frictional force clearly will depend on how hard the surfaces are being pressed together, or the normal force between the surfaces. And as I try to slide them, the frictional force acts at right angles to that normal. It keeps them from sliding, if you want to think of it that way, or it tries to anyway. So if I have two surfaces butted up against each other, like so, then the red surface, for example, might exert a normal force on the blue surface. And if the blue surface is moving with a velocity vector, like so, then what's going to happen is there will be a frictional force on the blue surface, which is going opposite the direction of motion, which I'm going to call F with a little sub FR, force of friction. And so if I ask, what is the force of the red object on the blue object, if the blue object is moving this way, there will be a force that is proportional to this normal force. I've already said that force is stronger the harder you push. And it will be opposite the direction of motion of this. So it acts to sort of slow it down. This represents the force of the red on the blue. There will be an equal and opposite reaction force of the blue on the red, so it will be sort of dragging the red this way, if you want to look at the forces on the red. And in Newton's law problems, remember you take each piece and you look at the forces on it. So the subtle thing with the frictional force is if this one exerts a frictional force on that one is also exerting a frictional force on this one in an equal and opposite direction. So you have to always take that into account when you're doing force sums. So, we will talk about the force of kinetic friction. Which is defined to be the force of friction between two moving surfaces. So when I say kinetic, I mean motion. Something's moving. And we're going to say that the magnitude of the force of kinetic friction is proportional to so sometimes alpha will be an angle. And sometimes it will be my symbol for proportional to. And you have to figure out what it is by context, just to keep you on your toes. We know that it is proportional to the normal force between the surfaces. I'm going to call that constant of proportionality a mu sub k, where k stands for kinetic, times n. And this mu sub k is what we will call the coefficient
of kinetic friction.
So clearly, it depends on whether how hard the surfaces are pushing against each other. So that's what you mean when you talk about it's proportional to the normal force. So that makes sense. It also depends on what the surfaces are. If I have hands made of Teflon and I do this, they're going to slide pretty easily regardless of how hard I push them together. So the coefficient of kinetic friction in that case will be very small. If I have hands that are like sandpaper, then they're going to be really hard to slide against one another, even if the normal force is fairly small. The coefficient of kinetic friction will be very large. So somewhere, someplace, our engineers whose jobs are to actually measure the coefficients of kinetic friction between different surfaces and make tables of them that other people can use. Now there's a job. But it's actually very important. Right? If you want to design a car, you would like to have small coefficients of kinetic friction between all the moving parts. And that can be worth billions of dollars and save lots of money for the environment because you use less energy to move the car and things like that. So these kinds of things, as trivial as they may seem to be, can be extremely important. So at any rate, coefficient of kinetic friction, and this quantifies surfaces that are moving with respect to each other. So this is like you have something, you have another box, and you have this thing moving with some non-zero velocity. Okay? In which case, you will have the force of kinetic friction will be working to, on the box, will be working to oppose the motion. You good with that? Now, have you ever experienced where you're like pushing a car or a big box of books or something on the floor and you can't get it moving and you can't get it moving and you push harder and harder and all of a sudden it starts to move. And once it starts to move, it seems to move fairly easily. Okay? The frictional force of the floor on the books or the whatever on the car, as it's moving, is this. But what you notice is that before it begins to move, you have a larger friction. That is, you have to push harder to get it moving than you do to keep it moving. And it, from a microscopic sense, it makes sense. If I have these two surfaces with lots of pits on them, for example, if it's just sitting there at rest, those pits are nicely intertwined, and I literally have to basically break things and get it moving. Once it's moving, you can imagine these surfaces sort of skipping on each other, and they don't really get settled. They don't adhere so much. So the physical process that's holding you is a little different once they're moving than it is if they're not moving. Which means we have to quantify the friction a little bit differently. So we have what is known as the force of static friction. Which is the force of friction between two surfaces at rest with respect to one another. All right, so this we quantify as the same thing because, again, it depends on how heavy or how big the normal force is. But now the coefficient that we use we call mu sub s. And this coefficient is called the coefficient of static friction. Which is larger? The coefficient of kinetic friction or the coefficient of static friction? Static is larger because you know that the force of friction of the object not moving can be larger.
There's a huge subtlety here. So if you're going to sleep, wake up. This represents the limiting value of the static friction. That is, this is as big as it can get. Another way to say it is the force of friction, static, is less than or equal to mu sub s times n. Actually, I should go ahead and put that here.
What does that really mean? Here's my box of books, okay? It is not going anywhere. No one's pushing on it. Now I'm going to push on it lightly. It is not going anywhere. The reason it does not go anywhere, well, it would. If it were on ice and there were no friction, it would go. It's not going because there's a frictional force that is opposing my normal force on the box. But it's only equal and opposite. It only needs to be equal and opposite to actually keep the acceleration zero. I can push a lot harder, and it's still zero, but the force of friction has gotten bigger, because it has to be bigger to counterbalance my larger push. So the force of static friction can be smaller than mu sub s n. Mu sub s n is that value where I am pushing harder and harder and harder, and at the very instant that it begins to move, that is mu sub s times n. So it is that limiting value where it just begins to move. But it isn't moving yet. Okay, so it's the threshold. It is the largest value that this frictional force can be. If I push one tiny bit harder, the friction gives and it starts sliding. Okay? So bear that in mind as you do problems, because that's generally the most subtle piece of it.